Hello, all. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are listening to this right now. And welcome to the Goddess Project podcast. It has been so long since I've seen you all. It has been like a year since I've seen you all. And so, hi. Hi. So, to all of you who have watched my episodes and have been with me along the way, hi. It is so good to see you. And to those of you that are joining, hi. My name is Dr. Carla Ionescu, and I am the host and the speaker and the lecturer of the Goddess Project podcast. So much has happened in a year, and here I am back in my little horn style pigtails, and it feels fun. It feels great. I'm very, very excited to be able to record again and to be excited about recording again and to talk to you about different topics. So today's topic is Anaduana, who is the priestess of Inanna, but also the very first writer of poetry and of worship, and just the first to write anything, even before Homer. So we are going to look at Anaduana and her story, which I think is coming to light more and more nowadays, which is really exciting. And scholars are beginning to accept more and more of her authority over the work that is attributed to her. You know, there was for a long time there was hesitation of ascribing what is literally written in stone in the Sumerian and the Akkadian tablets to her and to speak about her. And so I've become a little bit fascinated with her. I'm doing a workshop through the Artemis Research Center on Inanna herself, where I'm going to share with you all of my own personal images from museums that are connected to and related to Inanna. And so I'm really excited about that. And in putting that together, I realized that I never really talked about Anaduana, and I don't have time in our 2-hour workshop to talk about both of these amazing figures. And so I thought, hey, let's do the very first podcast, the very first return of the podcast on the very first woman that wrote in honor of the goddess that she worshipped. And I think it's really fitting because, as some of you know, oops, what am I doing? I'm sharing with you my notes. But as some of you know, writing in worship of a goddess and working in worship of a goddess has been something that I have been so passionate about when it comes to Artemis, you know? And when I read Anaduana's work and poetry, it hearkens, it calls to that part of me that is dedicated to Artemis in a way that is deeply personal but also public. So one of the things about Anaduana that's really interesting, that feels really relatable to me and perhaps to many of you, is that there is a very public aspect to her career and her worship and her priesthood for Inanna, but also to her writing. And her writing is published, and it's expected to be published. And you know, today when we look at a lot of women's writings, especially for the goddess, there is sometimes a connotation, a dismissive connotation to that, in the sense that, you know, woman talking about how much she worships the goddess. And certainly in academia, that's not even a possibility, in the sense of, you know, write, unless you're maybe an English PhD or something like that, but writing poetry and writing almost autobiography, but about your connection to the divine, is really set aside for the religious realm or the spiritual realm. And that's all right in some ways, but what happens to the many of us that are professionals in very restrictive fields, but are also spiritualists in other ways? And so maybe that's a question I have to answer. Maybe that's not something that you find relatable. But it's something that I've been feeling more and more called to do because I've been feeling more and more called to write. And I've always loved writing and I am a writer, but I don't like to share it. Whether it's like poetry or I don't know, a story that's something that's happened to me. So a retelling of a vision or a journey or an event or something like that, or even some autobiographical aspects or personal aspects. I write all that stuff, but I don't share it. It's very vulnerable, right? But Anna Duana has kind of come into my purview in a time when I feel like the goddess is asking me, Artemis, not Inanna, asking me to share at least some of the journeys that we've had together. And so, as I was reading the poems of Ena Duana in preparation for our talk today, I thought a lot about how I can share and whether or not and how much of my own writings that are really between me and the goddess that I should share. So, if you feel that way, if you feel inspired, or if you've written about your own personal relationships with the goddess, any goddess, that calls to you, that's really amazing. And I would love to hear about your journey through that, and your reflection through that. We're going to look at Ena Duanas a little bit because she does put in a lot of autobiographical aspects. And she talks about how, number one, she kind of births this thing. She births this writing, this burgeoning expression of dedication and love. And then number two, she writes it, how do I say this? It's an exaltation of the goddess, but in many ways, it's also a revelation of the goddess. How does the goddess relate to Ena Duana? What does that mean to her? So it's both public and personal, which, is super, super exciting. So I thought that we would dive into the work. And then if you want to stick around for the end, I'll tell you all the fun things that I'm doing this year and certainly for the next few months with the Artemis Research Center and with the goddess and with this podcast and everything. So, but I thought that we would dive in for some of you that are like, okay, Carla, I'm not interested. Let's just get to the material. Yeah. Okay, so let's begin by looking at who Ena Duana is and what does it mean to be a first. So when people hear the word like the first author, I say this in quotation mark, they often they think about later Greek epic. And this is why I call this episode Before Homer, because Ena Duana is writing way before Homer, okay? Way before Homer. So Mesopotamia really forces us to think and revise this habit of, or this almost this indoctrination of thinking that the first writer or the first epic writer is Homer. He's not. So in surviving cuneiform tradition, the earliest author whose name is attached to a major body of literature is Ena Duana. And she was a high priestess, actually, a high priestess to several gods, and we'll talk about how she was first assigned to the moon god. But she was a high priestess, and she was placed in this position around 2285 to 2250 BCE, so about 5,000 years ago, give or take. Now, when we use the word first, again, I say that in quotation mark, we have to be a little bit careful because we're not talking about the first person to compose words, or we're not talking about the first literate person. What we're talking about is the first figure whose name is preserved inside the tradition of literary text, right? In a way that, for example, in a way that later scribes were copying, teaching, and remembering. So almost like, she signed her name to a kind of textbook, to a kind of, well, an epic story or epic poetry. And this became a focus of storytelling for future generations, right? For her, the strongest sort of authorship signal is that She names herself. She says at the end, for example, so at the closing of this collection known as the Temple Hymns, she says the compiler of the tablets is an Edwana. And in fact, the next line she says, she writes, something has been created that no one has created before. So Ena Duwana is not just a naive, accidental first author, okay? She is purposely etching her name into stone and then telling you and me, imagine 5,000 years later, we're talking about her, that this is something that no one else has created before. And so, and what she's created is, of course, the short collection of temple hymns. And these temple hymns praised various Mesopotamian sanctuaries. She's collected, she's written these last hymns herself, or these collection of hymns herself. One of her most popular pieces is the Exaltation of Inanna. And what's really interesting about the Exaltation of Inanna, and we'll get into reading a bit of it in a minute, is that the speaker steps forward, and Edwana steps forward and identifies herself as I, in a way that reads like testimony, right? She says, I, the high priestess, I, and Edwana. And so I want to start off by talking about this woman's brilliance. This is not, like I said, it's not a naive attempt at writing. It's not an accidental attempt at writing, like, she's writing in her diaries and they get discovered kind of thing. This is institutional power and institutional memory. Her name endures because scribal schools preserve her work for centuries, because her voice matters, right? Her voice matters enough. Her writing is important enough that it is taught to future generations. And the fact that she uses a combination of her sacred office plus the I makes her this foundational figure for thinking about gender and authority and literary history, right? Unfortunately, we do not actually have the very first tablet that she wrote on. We don't actually have her original work. We have later copies, right? But this is very normal for Sumerian literature. While I would love to have copies of the originals, as we all would, what's really important is that there were so many copies made because she was so popular that she survived, and that she is part of the cultural authority at this time. And so this is why I call her one of the firsts. But just so that we understand that the first doesn't mean like the first person to ever scribe anything down, but the first person to do several impactful and public literary expansions. And of course, long before Homer, but also it is difficult to know the context of like the impact that her work has. So we know that her work is multi-copied, which tells us that people used it, people taught it, people copied it, people expressed it, people sang the hymns, people said the poetry. You would think, okay, that's amazing. That makes sense. That's impactful. But it would be interesting to see the wave of that impact moving forward through history, How many other cultures through which this work spread to and time periods influenced the way that people wrote about their gods, or even that people wrote either poetry or autobiographical, or the I. Yeah. So, needless to say, I'm very, very excited about just bringing her to the forefront. You know, more and more people are talking about her. It reminds me very much, of how many women have been forgotten in history, and how, we forget that people like Socrates had a female teacher. You know, Aspasia taught Socrates, and then Socrates taught Plato, and Plato taught Aristotle, and therefore Aspasia is really the matriarch of the entire philosophical foundation of the Western world. Right. In the same way, I think, and we're starting to talk about Aspasia now more and more. I think she's becoming more and more public, and perhaps we'll do an episode on her. It's just not as much as known as Enna Duanna, who of course signs her name. Yeah. So perhaps Aspasia did too. It's just nothing survived. So I think that it's important that we clarify the lineage. And that we include all of the literary contributors to the historical lineage of literary text or epic poetry or poems or etc. Okay. So we are in Akkadian Mesopotamia. This is the time period that we're in. So by the late 4th century, by the late 24th century BCE, the Akkadian king Sargon had united the majority of Mesopotamia under his authority. And he really paved the way for the very first world empire, or the world's first empire, the Akkadian Empire. And Sargon appointed, and Enna Duanna is Sargon's daughter, and Sargon appoints Enna Duanna as the high priestess of the moon god Nanna in Ur. And this was his effort to consolidate the empire. To bring it all together under a religious unity, right? Enna Duanna's writings are all in Sumerian, despite her Akkadian origins, and the Sumerian goddess is Inanna, and then the Akkadian goddess is Ishtar, the counterpart. So we're gonna look a little bit at the parallel of these two goddesses. So the Sumerians worship Inanna, Sargon comes in and begins to unite the empire under Akkadian rule. He appoints his daughter Enna Duanna as the high priestess of the moon god Nanna, and then who is a male god, by the way. And then over time, there is this overlap, fusion movement from Inanna Ishtar, which many of you might know is almost the same divinity. Okay, we'll look at both Inanna and Ishtar in a minute. And so much of the poetry, certainly, and much of what was written in Mesopotamian literature was often unattributed. So people just wrote, but they didn't sign their names. You know, it wasn't really a tradition to sign your name to anything, but Enna Duanna purposely signs her name. I find this fascinating. Something clicked for her. Perhaps it was because of all the things that she goes through in her life, as we'll see. But something clicks for her that goes, you know what? I'm going to put my name on this thing, right? And so she introduces herself by name in at least two of her poems, the Exaltation of Inanna and a Hymn to Inanna. And then there's a third one called Inanna and Ebi, where Inanna and Ebi are fighting, and Inanna sort of destroys Ebi. She doesn't, yeah. He tests her. He disrespects her, and Inanna does not take disrespect well. The third one is attributed to Enna Duanna because it's in her style, but she doesn't sign that one. Yeah. So, as Sargon is uniting these four quarters, as he calls them, which is really a way to say that he's expressing universal rule, right? He is organizing a reorg and reorganizing a system where royal women already hold high cultic offices. And in the Akkadian Empire, they continue to hold high cultic offices. And these high cultic offices serve multiple purposes. So they are linked primarily, they link dynasty to deity. Okay. So what that means is that the law, like the religious centers, the divine worship is linked to the king, the royal ruler, and then that is symbolically fusing cosmic order and political order. Okay. So, and Edwana is placed as an En priestess, EN, okay, which she sometimes refers to as the crown, as so she wears the crown of priesthood. And so we must understand this against this background. Like, we must understand her placement and her position and the purpose for her writing and perhaps even signing her name. And so, because she has this title of N, she stands at one of the central nodes in this combination, in this amalgamation of roles. And so, what happens then, of course, is that she has significant power. And elite women could occupy these structurally powerful roles, which were sometimes a little bit precarious and vulnerable, but they still occupy these really important roles, which I think have really gotten dismissed or ignored throughout history. Imagine how many elite women would have been in these positions, and perhaps many of them wrote, but because they didn't sign their name, we don't know. And so Eduana is, and Eduana is not just writing, like I said, it's not private reflection. She is really producing something inside an imperial world where theology, where governance, and specifically gendered authority is tightly intertwined. One of the interesting things about this time period that, again, doesn't often get mentioned is how interconnected women are into the fabric of society. So you won't be surprised. Like, I feel like you won't be surprised because you've been listening to most of my podcasts for so long. And so you won't be surprised to know that women played key roles in everything from politics, like we just said, to literature, to economics, to cultic positions, to weaving, to material goods, etc. But this particular cylinder seal is really interesting to me because this particular cylinder seal, which is, predates Eduana by, I don't know, almost 1,000 years, has women, female figures, and cows. And I wanted to add this piece into our talk because there's a couple of things that go on here and this that this reminds me of. Okay, what you're seeing here is a lot of women and cows. So this automatically to me says agriculture and obviously herd raising, but what it says to me, and particularly this inscription, this cylinder seal, is that someone took the time to make the cylinder seal so that, there is a representation of something important to them, where women are a main focus of this agricultural life. And so it tells me that there is a great deal of authority and pride and collaboration, not only in the agricultural depiction here, which is perhaps out in a field, but in the economic investment of agriculture. So if we're living in an agrarian society, which of course the Sumerians were, as were the Akkadians, cattle are one of the primary sources of wealth, and in fact exhibit a great deal of wealth. And women being in charge of working with, and who knows, owning with among, among alongside their family, cattle has so many implications. And I don't want to read too much into the cylinder seal so that we can make a whole story up about it. But I did find it really unique. I had not seen a cylinder seal like this that has women and cattle together, sort of out grazing. It looks almost like they're kind of grazing. I can't tell if they're grazing or if they're in a market. Hard to really read. But and then there's also, I think we've talked about it many episodes ago, the idea that female cattle, cows, had long horns. Which I know is going to take me on a side rant, so I'm not going to go on a total side rant, but that cows, so that female cattle, had long horns in the ancient world. And so that then asks us to question all of the depictions of cattle with long horns. Are they really bulls? Or are they female? Are they cows? Yeah, with long horns. And we won't go into that right now, but I do feel like this particular seal shows us a little bit of sort of a predating of the influence, the power, the contribution of women in early Mesopotamia. That is, they were not kept indoors. They were not closed off from the world in the way that later on Athenian women are, for example. They seem to have been not just part of the domestic aspect of success for many of the households, but an important part of the public aspect of the household, of the community, of the cities. And while this may be perhaps not elite women or dynastic women in this particular seal, still, women are outside. They're contributing. They're a part of society. And yet we don't see them. We don't see them, like full stop. We don't see them. Yeah. So what does it mean to hold the title of N? So the title of N for Eneduanna, well, the title of N is conventionally translated as high priestess. And it's one of the most powerful cultic offices in early Mesopotamia. So she's not just the priestess. She is the high priestess. Yeah. This is not a symbolic, this is not an honorary role. This is the highest level of temple administration and ritual authority. She tells everyone else what to do. And so the office of N, EN, is especially prominent in major urban centers or urban cult centers. The high priestess oversees ritual calendars, offerings, temple personnel. So she's the office manager, she is the hiring manager. She oversees the inventory, the large temple estates that control land, labor, stored surplus. Okay. So the N stands at the intersection of religion and economy. Okay. She's not just running the office. She is in charge of the decision making. And those who want to be part of the temple process and who want to have, high honors and contribute and be part of the elite community, they come through her. Yeah. So this tells us that she understands everything from math to science of a kind to, of course, reading and writing, to negotiation, to contracts, to, right? So legal responsibility. We are talking about a CEO kind of high priestess. Yeah. We're talking about a public and visible and embodied priestess. And alongside with her power also came the way that she dresses, her regalia, her outfit, and her spatial access. That is, she has access to the entire temple complex. No space is restricted to her. Okay. So she's not, again, she's not thrown in some woman's corner or some nunnery or whatever it is. Yeah. And so the N, right, is her crown as high priestess, is her title as her high priestess. And so when people try to take that from her, she takes that very, very seriously. And in fact, there is a point where, she is being threatened to be kicked out of the temple, to be kicked out of her position, to lose this crown of N and this position. And she implores, she tells us in her writing that she implores the moon god Nanna, who is the one that she was placed to serve. But apparently, she writes, he remains indifferent to her. And so Enedwana turns to Inanna. And she says that Inanna is the one that answers her prayers because when she turns to Inanna, she is returned and restored to her office. So under the moon god Noon, she loses her office. She's challenged, and she loses her office and her authority. Yeah. And so in her prayers, or in her poems, she talks about how much power Inanna has in contributing and in changing the fate of her life. So I'm going to read you a little bit of what she says. She says about Inanna, she says, the Almighty Queen who presides over the priestly congregation, she accepted her prayer, Enedwana's prayer. Inanna's sublime will was for her restoration. It was a sweet moment for her. She was arrayed in her finest. She was beautiful beyond compare. Here she's talking about Inanna. She was lovely as a moonbeam streaming down. Nanna stepped forward to admire her, the moon god. Her divine mother, Ningal, joined him with her blessing. The very doorway gave its greeting to Inanna. What she commanded for her consecrated woman, Enedwana, prevailed. To you, who can destroy countries, whose cosmic powers are bestowed by heaven, to my queen arrayed in beauty, to Inanna be praise. So, this is a small piece of the poem, but what's really fascinating here is that, Enedwana is challenged and removed from her position by a man. She turns to the moon god Nanna and says, all while this is happening, and says, help me, help me, help me. And there's no answer. She then turns to the goddess Inanna, the great queen, and says, help me, help me. And Enedwana is returned to her position as high priestess. And then she writes this exaltation. But in the exaltation, the god Nanna, the moon god, is also there accepting the command of the queen Inanna. Yeah. So, what this really shows us here, and so in sort of a non-spiritual space, what this really shows us is that women's authority may have, like all authority in some ways, been precarious, right? And so that the same structures that raise women, which is her father's authority, to this high priestess position, can be challenged, sometimes violently challenged, and women can be expelled from those positions. Now, to be fair, that can also happen to men, but particularly to women, and particularly to powerful women, intelligent women, et cetera, et cetera. And so this poem does more than just tell us this devotion to Inanna. It actually shows us this female account of institutional dispossession. Right? It shows us that Inanna has the authority to reverse the violence of men, or the commands of men. Does that make sense? And so the exaltation to Inanna is not just when we think about, for example, Sappho to Aphrodite. You know, Sappho loves Aphrodite. Sappho worships Aphrodite. Sappho is in a romantic, almost intimate relationship with Aphrodite. And of course, there's lots of room and lots of time for those kind of poetry as well, for that kind of poetry as well. But what we have here with Enedwana is a kind of political, like real world, economical adoration, but also authority given to Inanna. I just find that particularly powerful. Yeah. And then because that happens, so because the attempt to re because the removal of Inaduana at first is overturned, and because she attributes that to Inanna, now Inaduana is even more powerful. And in fact, she becomes so powerful and so influential because she has the favor of this goddess, right? Very clearly. And she says so. She herself says so. And so I wanted to show you this piece, which is another seal. But this seal is really cool because it has Enedwana in it. It's hard to see, I know. It has Enedwana in her in it, and it has Enedwana and her hairdresser, okay, in it. So what happens is because Enedwana is blessed by Inanna, her entire entourage become protected by Inanna. And they become sort of like, I want to say kind of like celebrities, but maybe that's not the right word. But they are they are exaltated. That's not the right word, but to this position of favored. And so not only is she favored, everyone in her entourage is favored. And then so you get to see seals like this, where of course she is on the seal, but so are people in her entourage. And so I thought that was really cool. And also this idea of comfort and wealth and support and all of these things that come through with being favored by the goddess, being very clearly and visually and economically and politically favored by the goddess. So it's not that she's saying, hey, I went into the woods and I had a vision and the goddess loves me. She's saying, hey, you try to knock me off my throne and the goddess put me back on. So yeah, that's who I am, right? And so the exaltation of Inanna, the entire poem and the entire composition is extremely influential and ex analytically rich, right? Now, again, we don't have the original copy. We have multiple later copies, and it's normally cataloged as a Sumerian literary hymn, but it is dated to about the late 3rd millennium BCE. And manuscripts that are preserved come mostly from the Old Babylonian period, which is about 1900 to 1600 BCE. And so that is a good, again, a little less than 1,000 years after Eneduanna. The poem itself is about 160 lines long. It's structurally complex. It begins with this traditional hymn of praise and then goes into a dramatic shift into personal testimony. So again, right, we have this historical unprecedented shift. Okay. Like earlier hymns speak about gods and gods only. But here, the speaker begins to speak about Inanna and then speaks as herself, placing her personal experience inside the entire sacred genre. And so that is when she names herself, right? And she calls herself I. Yeah. She and inserts herself into the poem. She really does something symbolically untraditional. Yeah. And as I said earlier, she taught and Eduana talks about how this poem is so it is like a cry inside of her. It's so powerful inside her that she can't keep it in, and she has to like birth it out, which is also very, very remarkable. Okay, so let me read to you what she says. She says, "One has heaped up the coals in the censer, prepared the lustration. The nuptial chamber awaits you. Let your heart be appeased with. It is enough for me. It is too much for me. I have given birth, O exalted lady, to this song for you. That which I recited to you at midnight, may the singer repeat it to you at noon." And so there is this like deluge inside of her that's coming out, which is also something that's very unique in at this time in writing, that the relationship between her and Inanna is almost like out of her control, out of her choice, that Inanna not only has favored and supported her, but is sort of blowing through her in this creative form. Now, we know that Inanna is one of the most powerful and complex deities in ancient Mesopotamia, and you know there's a whole podcast episode that deals with some of Inanna's worship. We could probably do a year on Inanna worship because there's just so many layers. The one that I did last was just on the descent itself, just on Inanna's descent and the meaning of that descent. But Inanna herself is this powerful, complex deity, and she was already central to Sumerian religion centuries before Eneduanna was even born, right? And so by the 4th millennium BCE, we have the earliest symbolic representation of deities. At first, Inanna is represented as a reed ring bundle, and you might have seen some of the reed ring bundles, which is served as doorposts in marshes. And then slowly she be and it's just a reed bundle, and then it's her name. But slowly she becomes more and more human-like. Slowly she embodies more and more of a human figure, right? She was known to be warlike, fierce, unforgiven, but to those that she favors, especially kings, she legitimizes their political power and allows them to win in battle, right? And in fact, it is very important that the king and Inanna are in a mutual relationship. Very, very important to the authority of the king. And people would know that they're in a mutual relationship because, the herds were successful, agriculture was successful, things were going well. So when things are going well, seems like Inanna is favoring the king, and things are all good. So Inanna can give power and she can remove power. And so she was both feared and loved. And Eneduanna, so okay, Inanna's power is expressed through something called meh, M-E, which are these divine ordinances that structure a civilization, right? Including political authority and social order. And so for a god or a goddess to be this powerful and this much in control, she has to have sovereignty over these meh, right? And Eduana consistently emphasizes Inanna's sovereignty over the meh. She presents her as the source of ultimate legitimacy. Yeah. And so, for example, let me see. In her, when she's writing the exaltation to Inanna, she embeds Inanna's authority over this meh and then names herself as well. Okay, let me show you an example. Okay, so for example, there's this section where Eneduanna includes these autobiographical details. So she has a struggle against this dude called Lugalane, most likely, which is the historically attested king of Ur, who is the one that attempted to forcibly remove her from her office. So when she's writing, she does this combination. Okay, let me show you. So she says, "Yes, I took up my place." So here she's speaking about herself. I, in the sanctuary dwelling, I was high priestess. I, Eneduanna, though I bore the offering basket, though I chanted the hymns, a death offering was ready. Was I no longer living? Right. So something is gone wrong. I went towards the light and it felt scorching to me. I went towards the shade. It shrouded me in swirling dust. A slobbered hand was laid across my honeyed mouth. So someone is trying to silence her. What was fairest in my nature was turned to dirt, my reputation. O moon god, is this Lugalane my destiny? Is this dude really going to take me out? Tell heaven to set me free. Just say it to heaven. Heaven will set me free. So this is the way that she talks about being removed, right? When Lugalane stood paramount, he expelled me from the temple. He made me fly out the window like a swallow. I had had my taste of life. He made me walk a land of thorns. He took away the noble diadem, the crown, the end of my holy office. He gave me a dagger and said, "This is just for you," he said. And so this idea of being removed from her interconnection with her political position is then contradicted or reconsidered, yeah, when she realizes, when Nidwana realizes that actually it is Inanna that has the authority to both put me back into office, but the authority of the office itself. Yeah. And so then when Anadwana writes about Inanna having the meh, right? All the attributes as the goddess who holds meh, she says she took the divine meh of the offices of the priesthood, the kingship, the truth, the descent into the underworld, and brought them to her city. So Anadwana is now raising or acknowledging, one would say, the power of Inanna. And in fact, she addresses her often as Lady of all the divine powers. She's naming her as the holder of Meh. And so it makes sense that Inanna then would be the one that has brought her back and actually puts her back into her chair as the high priestess and her position as high priestess. Okay, moving on. Let's talk a little bit about Ishtar. So, in Iduana's writings, influence significantly the fusion between Inanna and Ishtar in Ishtar's later eclipsing Inanna. So, Ishtar becomes the foundation of the Akkadian Empire, which is often referred to as the dynasty of Ishtar in later historical resources. There's an inscription from the time of King Naram-Sin, who is Eneduanna's nephew and Sargon's grandson, who states that it is through Ishtar's love that Naram-Sin rules the land. Okay. So Eneduanna's temple hymns culminate with Ishtar's temple at Agadi, which is the capital of the Akkadian Empire. And it indicates its primacy in the exaltation of Inanna. So in the exaltation of Inanna, it is, how do I say this? It is this combination of Ishtar Inanna that helps the high priestess restore order, right? The way that Eneduanna describes Inanna, her propensity for violence, her association with fertility, her superiority within the Mesopotamian pantheon, most likely influenced contemporary portrayals of Ishtar. So I don't know how to, I don't know this, I, this feels like it doesn't make sense. So while Inanna, let me see if we can see if make this that makes sense. While Eneduanna is writing about Inanna in the same exaltation, let's use that word, that the Akkadian dynasty holds Ishtar, it is very, very clear to see that it could be Eneduanna's writing that really blends these two goddesses. What I mean by that is that it's very clear that the public can visually understand Ishtar and Inanna as one goddess. And some scholars argue that it is because of Eneduanna's writings, because it's right on that cusp of Sumerian Akkadian blend. So it is because Eneduanna's writing that Ishtar is often shown in this dominating position, which I have here behind me, and it's famously all over the internet, where she is dominating these formidable lions, often standing on top of lions, but also looking right at the viewer. Okay. And she's got maces or sickle axes on her shoulders. And so these are some of the images that are said to be inspired by Eneduanna's writing. The overlap of Inanna and Ishtar is in the similarities in the threatening and fertility representation of both of these goddesses. But one could argue that it is also in the fact that Eneduanna, who is an Akkadian princess slash high priestess, whom Inanna favors, may can be easily accommodated into Ishtar favoring. Of course, Ishtar favors the Akkadian princess. And so does Inanna. Oh, perhaps these two are very, very overlapping. Does that make sense? And I say that over and over again just because it's fascinating to me how we take for granted this blend of Inanna Ishtar. That is, we were like, oh yeah, of course Ishtar was Inanna, and of course Inanna was Ishtar, even though they're part of these two separate cultures, but they're very similar, blah blah blah. But the person in the middle, the glue that holds this together, or brings this together, or clarifies this together. Now, would Eneduanna have known that exalting Inanna while also being part of Ishtar's culture would have blended the two? I don't know. I mean, it seems like a really good way for the princess of a new Akkadian king that is trying to pull together the Sumerians under his empire and keep the peace, right? It's really good political strategy. It's not, again, it's not just accidental creativity. It's very, very good political tactics. It's extremely influential. Extremely influential. Yeah. And so then that leads me to scribal transmission and cultural memory. So we know that Eneduanna's writings are foundational because they have been preserved through so many copies. They were produced and reproduced in scribal schools, which means you knew about Eneduanna and her writing from when you were a little kid learning how to write. So st students learn how to write copying authoritative compositions of her work. Yeah. So that is a really strong indicator of long-term cultural value. Yeah. And again, they would have recognized that her name is in the writing because they would have had to write her name over and over and over, And the thing that's fascinating too is that no one took out her name. So in the copying and recopying, they could have easily had taken out her name, but they didn't. And so, that's kind of interesting that that seems to say that they respected her, that they honored her, that they liked the fact that she placed herself right in there. And for example, in the temple hymns, which would have been used at all the mass temple centers, her name is preserved very much, where she says, "I wrote this, and this is something that no one has done before." Right? I am the compiler of these tablets, and no one else has done that before. And so, in a sense, Eneduanna is the authority of memory, and the scribal culture that continues copying her work are the keeper of that, are the keepers of that memory. And so it's important for us to note that. We know this because her voice survived because the institutions chose to copy them. Again, there may have been many women writing at the time who maybe didn't put their name on their work. I guarantee that that's the case. But there may have even been other women at the time that maybe signed their name or et cetera, but that were not important enough within the culture to get the kind of publicity that Eneduanna got. Yeah. And of course, this ha also has to do with her elite status, right? She is the princess. She is historically embedded into the history of the Akkadian Empire. Very difficult to erase her out of context. But also, what's interesting is the importance of copying. That shows us that literary memory is quite fragile, right? Many voices, like I said, were not preserved. And this brings me back to Socrates and Aspasia. Not that women didn't write in the ancient world. So I want to make that very clear. Lots of women wrote in the ancient world. I want to say hundreds, thousands of women, because many of them were elite, but also many, many women were taught some type of form of writing, more than I think we believe and we've been taught to believe. But because for some reason those were not copied or lost or destroyed or, whatever, time just tends to denigrate some of that material, because it does also for male authors that we have lost. We don't have those voices, right? And so I think Ena Duwanna stands at this really important point in our cultural societal movement forward, because it allows us at least one opportunity to see the collective and the institutional honor and read and participate in the storytelling and the creative expression of a woman that was influential. Yeah. So her voice really shaped how future generations learned to think about gods. Her voice really shaped how future generations saw their relationship with both Inanna and Ishtar, or Inanna Ishtar. And that's huge in a time period where the gods are politically, economically, and spiritually in the fabric of society. And so it's important that we talk about not just the fact that she wrote things, which she did and wrote her name on it, but that she was revered enough to be copied over and over and over, copied carefully, copied honorably, copied as part of a learning process, and that in that copying, the cultural memory is preserved. And therefore, she preserves, or she is the initiator of preservation of cultural memory. It's powerful. I don't know if you're feeling it, but it feels powerful. And then her the sort of gendered violence, the tension, well, the violence that she feels in Edwana herself, becomes part of a movement to collapse female authority. So even in Eduana and Ena Eduana's time, we see a literary account of a woman in power being violently removed from office by a man. She doesn't describe this as a symbolic fall. She describes this as a physical expulsion, as ritual stripping, right? She says, he takes everything from me, he stripped everything from me, and then he even gave me a dagger, and implying, like, take your own life and get out. And so it really shows us the threat of gendered authority that was becoming more and more policed, and that was becoming more and more policed through violence, especially when women occupied public and religious or political power. And of course, we're not surprised to know that as we move forward through time, that becomes more and more of an issue where women start to, women are forced into sort of ruling or influencing from behind a man, right? And you have that ridiculous saying of behind every successful man is a woman doing something. The main idea being there behind, right? But Ena Duwanna really describes the devastation, the humiliation that she faced, right? At one point, she says, he made me walk among the thorn bushes of the mountains. He really wanted to set me low, 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 right? You are displaced, you are sent into this hostile marginal space, you are stripped of your office, of course, but it's not just your office, right? It's your authority, it's your legitimacy. And she writes about that. I mean, what's fascinating to me is that we have a primary account of this woman 5,000 years ago talking about this dude taking her job or just firing her for being a woman. I mean, 5,000 years later, and what has changed? Yeah, my friends, like what? Like there is, so historically speaking, I think that there is such importance in having her writing and also in having her expression of what that feels like. So it's not just a mark in history. Oh, Anadwoma priestess was removed, by Lugalana, blah blah blah. But we have her words, we have her the way that she is stating this violation, this coercion, this et cetera. Yeah. And then of course the fact that he puts a dagger in her hand and says that this is good for you, which is really a way of saying it's good for you to take that dagger and do something with it. I guess what I want to leave you with here is that she does not comply. Yeah, she persists. Eneduanna persists. I mean, thank the goddess, so many women persisted. Where would we be without the persistence? She persists. She speaks. She writes. The act of writing becomes resistance. The poem preserves her testimony when these institutional structures failed her, right? And it's her naming the violence that's being done to her, insisting that it's heard within a sacred framework. So these are poems by a high priestess, at this point, an ex-high priestess, to the goddess or about the goddess, about this violence that's been done to her. And so it publicly names what's happening to her, but it also keeps it within the sacred framework, right? I don't know how to explain it, but it's so impactful to have this literary record of how power and gender and violence intersected in this moment in time, and how she persisted and how she was successful. Yeah. So her abandonment by the god, the moon god Nanna, who sometimes is called Suen or Sin, you may be familiar with him here. Shows again unreliability of masculinity. Yeah. She narrates this in her poetry. She narrates this crucial theological and emotional turning points. She goes to the god Nanna, and this is the deity where she's held this office, right? The god most closely associated with an institutional role, and is ignored. Yeah. So Nanna represents establishment, patriarchy, institutional authority. He ignores her. He's also a god that's tied to continuity and order and legitimacy. He ignores her. Okay. And so it feels like at first, this is her conditioning. This is one of the gods or the main gods that I worship, and he's a dude, and I'm going to pray to him, and he's going to save me and protect me. So this is part of her training in a way, right? Her conditioning. But he doesn't. Yeah. He doesn't. But instead, and so she says in her poem, she goes, Suen did not stand by me. He did not judge my case. Yeah. He didn't protect me. Yeah. And then she says, well, so then I turned to Inanna. And she, after this, feeling of abandonment, and she says, I gave free vent to my tears like sweet milk for holy Inanna. So she turns. She goes, you know what? I just gave up and I offered all of my suffering and all of my tears to Inanna. And it is here that restoration begins. So it is in this offering, ironically, it is in this offering of emotional overwhelm to Inanna that the goddess answers and restores. So the rational training to submit to the male god into law, into legislation, into order goes unheard. So, I mean, Enedwana is really making a statement here within a statement, right? She's really saying, like, the dudes suck. These dudes that I'm surrounded with suck. You know what I mean? Okay, my father put me here, which already so men gave me this authority, but the authority is mine now. Okay, I have this N, I have this crown, I have this position. And then this guy, this king of Ur, another, another place, another city, is coming and demotes me, throws me out, takes away all my power. So these are men things that are happening all around me, right? Man appoints me, man removes me, and I worship this moon male god. And I turn to the structure that I'm working with and that I'm placed in, and I turn and I sort of offer this rational, plea of like, what is going on? Obviously, this is unjust. This man has just come to remove me for no reason. And again, total silence. And then when I'm like, you know what, like, screw it, I'm devastated, I'm overwhelmed, I'm emotional now, so let all that emotion build up, pour out. I offer that to Inanna. And it is Inanna who answers and restores. I've said that again because it's the restoration that's the political power move, right? Answering is great. Loving, appearing, great, all good things. But being restored, so regaining your political position, the minute you turn to the goddess, the opportunity opens up for you to be restored, is really where the genius of this piece of writing is. And I don't know if everyone saw that genius of piece of writing, or they just thought, well, the god Inanna or Sin didn't answer her, so she turned to Inanna, and therefore, she was answered. I don't know if people saw that as simply as that, or if they really saw her genius in sort of in structuring her story to say all of this could not encompass and could not help and could not provide and could not do anything that I needed to do. Even though it claims to be authority, but just this alone, Inanna alone, placed me back and gave me power. So you see the political statement that I'm saying here, right? Like, there's a very clear message that's being, of who holds the true power, who holds all the meh, right? All the divine power, all the primordial power, and who answers prayers. And then, like I said earlier in the poem, when she says, even the god moon, the moon god Nana is there, as Enedwana is restored by Nana, the moon god is there too, going, oh yeah, this is good, very good. So this idea of Inanna just obliterating really all of her enemies, placing her back on a throne, it is a great story, and in fact, I think would make a great Hollywood film. Or Netflix film, at least, on the life of Enedwana. And I'm sure somewhere someone will do it. Hopefully they will do it well. But I hope that this is part of it, that there's a genius in here, there's a strategist in here, that's saying, like, screw you guys. You got nothing, you got nothing. Here you try to remove me from my rightful position, and Inanna comes in and just swept you. And not only that, but you have to stand there and accept her ruling. So it's quite genius. And we will talk more about Inanna next week, Saturday, at the workshop. I'm going to put all the information down below, if you would like to join me, because we're going to look at, again, some different aspects of Inanna. I know there's a lot of popular aspects of Inanna that are often discussed, and that's great. I think those were really important. But I think artifacts in particular, just like this literary text, really show us a more elaborate, a more complete story, of people and of cultural context of that time. And so and plus also I really like sharing with you all pieces that are not available easily on Google or the internet. Because again, I think those add layers of knowledge and understanding of people who created these pieces and the importance of them. So, thank you so much for being here with me and staying for this whole time. And I'm so super happy to be back. I hope to have an episode for you regularly moving forward, but whether or not regularly that means once every couple of weeks or once a month, that's, it is what it is. But because I am doing the yearly workshops, and then I'm going to be doing a course in February, an online course on the Mistress of Animals, because I'm really, really excited about putting together a book on the Mistress of Animals. And so putting all that stuff together and the workshops, and then I'm leading a tour in Greece, an Artemis Temples tour in Greece in April. I think there's still a few spots left. I want to say three or four spots are left. So, if you're inspired to come to Greece with us on this sort of study tour slash temple tour, and museum and other things, check out the links below and visit our website. And if you'd like to read more about my adventures on the mapping project, that expedition's going to happen in May, the next expedition, and I'm going to be in Sicily. Mapping Artemis Temples in Sicily. You can find me on Substack, where I write about some of these adventures under Artemis Expert. I mean, you can find me anywhere under Artemis Expert across all socials. And if you want to subscribe to our newsletter and find out what's going on, a monthly newsletter, join us through the Artemis Research Center. So I'm going to put all that data down below. It is wonderful to see you. If you'd like to join us for the Inanna workshop, which is happening next Saturday, I would be so happy to have you. I'll put that link below as well and see all of the artifacts that we're diving into. And yeah, it's so good to be back. And I thank you so much for watching and supporting and for being patient and staying with this channel and for your comments and your feedback. For all the things, thank you so much for giving me this space to talk about things that I find interesting, and for sending me sometimes your really nice messages and comments, which remind me that I'm not speaking into a void, and that some of you really enjoy the material. So, until next time, my friends. I hope you have a wonderful week, weekend, whenever you're listening to this, a wonderful day, and I will see you all next time.